Hey, everybody, and welcome to Learning from Smart People. I am your host, Rob Oliver, and I appreciate you being here today. Listen, I just have a real quick favor to ask of all of my listeners. And if you're, as you listen to this, maybe you're on Apple Podcasts, wherever you are, make sure you hit the subscribe button so that you don't miss an episode. If you are watching this on YouTube, go ahead and hit the subscribe button there. Make sure that you are catching every one of these episodes that comes out, because we are definitely learning from smart people. And I will prove that to you today by bringing in another smart person. Her name is Jen Thornton. She is from 304 Consulting. She is a speaker and all kinds of, it does amazing things. She's located in Dallas. And Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and I know we'll have a great time together.
Absolutely. So just let's start this way. Tell me a little bit about your backstory. Kind of where did you come from, and how did you get to where you are today?
I love sharing my story because it's not necessarily what people would guess or typical. I grew up in the retail industry, and from a very young age, I wanted to work at the mall. So that was obviously, we won't say how old I am, but it's probably before we were buying all of our stuff off of Amazon. We'll make that really clear. So I, dreams come true. I got my first job at the mall and started working in the retail industry very young. But what I didn't know then that I now know now is I was exposed to becoming a leader at a very, very young age. At 19 years old, they handed me keys to a store and said, you know, you get to run a, you know, a couple of night shifts. And so I not only loved the industry, but I loved leading people, and I loved chasing the KPIs and making sure we made payroll and all that stuff. And fast forward over, you know, quite a long period of time, I did a lot of different things in the retail industry. I spent half of my time on the operations side. Then I spent half of my time in HR, both domestically here in the US and all around the world. I had the opportunity to do work assignments in great places like Hong Kong and Mexico and London, and got to do all kinds of wonderful things. And then about, gosh, it's been about 4.5 years ago, I thought, okay, I have to eventually do something on my own. If I'm going to do it, it has to be now. And so I left my very amazing corporate career for a fantastic organization, fantastic job, and went out on this entrepreneurial, you know, journey. You know, one of those things that you just can't help yourself to do, but you have to do it. And you, there's no reason why on paper you should, but that was me, you know, had to do it. And I've been incredibly fortunate. We've created an amazing leadership education company. We have an amazing team, amazing clients, and I get to meet great people like you and your listeners. And so that's how I got here today.
Wonderful. Okay. One of the things that we do on the show is whenever anybody speaks in alphabet soup, you mentioned KPI, which I'm assuming is key performance indicators. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I love chasing numbers. I love knowing that the work pays off, which is really a different approach I take in leadership development. A lot of people talk about it from a conceptual standpoint, what you could do or should do. We here at 304, we talk about it from an impact standpoint. So how do we lead to ensure that we're delivering our business results? And so it's a much different way to approach leadership. And, you know, it's expensive to do leadership training. Now, it always pays off if it's done right. But we actually do return on investment, our ROI. When we work with people, we actually help them create ROIs at the end of that time period.
That's such an interesting concept, because so many times, I mean, leadership is kind of an ethereal, like it's not a measurable, especially when it comes to the financial return on that. Can you talk to me a little bit about how do you measure the return on investment for leadership?
There's a lot of different ways you can approach it, and depends. When we look at it, when we start with our objectives in the beginning, we start to say, okay, here are our measurable and KPIs towards the middle end or whatever time period we set up. But you can look at it from a retention standpoint. So when you have great leadership, people work because they want purpose and growth. And so if your retention starts to decrease, then that is something we can measure. If sick days go down or referrals for employment go up, those are all things we can measure. We can also measure how we're now making decisions. And so when we coach individual executives, after about 6 months, we talk to them about some of the decisions they're making now that they might not have been comfortable in making in the past or have found this new way to view things. And then we'll talk to them about that decision and what was that financial impact. And then we can start to put a return on investment on the work that that person's doing.
Got it. I want to go back to your story about your entrepreneurial journey. What were your emotions like when you were considering leaving your regular paycheck, your regular, your job where you've got, and you're saying, okay, I'm interested in pursuing the entrepreneurial concept. Like, what was the range of emotions that you were feeling at that point?
Oh my gosh, what was the range? I couldn't even describe it. The ranges were everywhere. It was up, it was down, it was at any given moment, a ton of fear. And at that time, I hadn't done a lot of the studying around the neuroscience of fear, which I've done now. And I'm like, oh, if I'd only known, that's what that was. So I had every emotion I think that I could put language to, especially that first probably 18 months. That first 18 months was a roller coaster. Every hour you called me, I had a different emotion to associate with
You know,
it.
it's funny. The roller coaster analogy is exactly what I was thinking, because when you go on a roller coaster, you want your adrenaline to spike. You want to have that just a little bit of fear and kind of like what, and so you have the anticipation and the excitement about it. You have the fear, and it's kind of all of that stuff wrapped together, and it is very much up and down. So you mentioned a phrase. You said the neuroscience of fear. What is that? And it's a concept I'm not familiar with. So can you explain it for me?
So one of the things I talk to my clients about a lot is fear, because when we go into a situation that is uncomfortable or new, or we have, our brain loves to predict. In the past, we've gone into the situation, it didn't go well. So our brain tries to tell us, well, it won't go well this time either. But our brain is built to protect us, it's built to keep us alive. And one of the ways it does that is by keeping you from danger. Now, obviously, danger could be falling off of a cliff. That would be bad. But danger also can be judgment or failure or ridicule or looking bad or any of those things that we worry about sometimes as leaders, those feelings that we have. It is just the fear kicking in. And as our fear chemicals go up in our brain, the access we have to our prefrontal cortex, where the good stuff is, emotional control and problem solving, all the stuff we actually want, it starts to go down. And so when we don't understand that these feelings are just a chemical reaction, that is all fear is. If we don't understand it's just a chemical reaction, then we start to play into it. We start to let it control us. And that fear will make our fear of whatever, that fear of failure, it will make it come true because we will be acting out of fear and not acting out of place of control.
Okay, so is it cyclical? Like the more you fear something, the more kind of anxious you are about it, and it becomes a spiral. Is that how it works?
Yeah, it does. And I call that kind of the fear cycle. And so when something happens and you're kind of like, I don't know about this, your brain starts to tell you things like, oh, this is bad. You shouldn't do it. That could be dangerous. You could be judged. You could fail. Your boss might get mad at you. You may never get a client. Your brain starts to tell you all that stuff. And we can either let those raw emotions manage our thoughts and continue on that, spiral, or we can say, hold up, you know, I'm in charge of my thoughts. I'm in charge of how I think about this situation. My brain is not, and it's not. You know, we actually can control how we feel about something. We can decide to feel different about a situation if we want to. Now, it's easier said than done, and I get that, and it takes practice. But your emotions are really the response to your brain predicting how you feel when those chemicals are released. And so you just have to start to remind yourself that, yeah, like, you know, this is nervous. Like, I got on this podcast today. I don't know what questions you're going to ask me. My brain can't predict it because I, you know, you and I don't know each other that well yet. And so I could have come on and worried about what you were going to ask me, or I could have come on like I did and say, this is going to be a great show. I always say that at the beginning because it's going to be, and I believe that. And because I believe that, then that happens. I, you know, said I get to meet someone new today. I can't wait to hear what he's all about. And so I chose what I told myself before I got on, instead of saying, oh gosh, I don't know what he's going to do. And I don't know if I'm going to be any good and who's going to care. You get to pick what you say to yourself. And that's how you show up based on what you picked.
Okay. When I think about fear, my mind goes to like Halloween. Okay. And on Halloween night, it's dark and you're out there and there's all people dressed up and there's crazy. And for me, you're out in the dark, you don't know what's going on. And then when you hear stuff, you know, a twig snaps or whatever it is, you interpret everything through a fear mindset, if that makes any sense. And now everything that you're experiencing is yet another cause for fear, which I think feeds into what you were saying, where you've got to be able to tell yourself that, okay, it's a chemical reaction. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Does my question make sense?
Absolutely, it does. And those fear chemicals are the same on Halloween night, or I was watching a TV series last night, and there's some, you know, anticipation and some suspense. And I always love that because I like watching how my body responds and how my body kicks off some chemicals, because my brain can't predict what's going to happen next. So then my brain's like, you know, warning, you know, we don't know what's happening next. Be careful. And that happens in a movie. It might happen on a Halloween night when you hear the twig. And it's interesting because your brain, you know, loves to predict. So, you know, on October 30th, when it's dark and you hear a twig, you're like, oh, that's weird. Well, twig just broke. Well, Halloween night, you hear the same thing, the same experience, but because your brain has all this history around Halloween being spooky and you know it's Halloween, it makes you more nervous when that same sound happens than when it had happened on October 30th, just the night before, which I think is fascinating that our brain has such an incredible memory of experiences and knowledge. And it uses all of that to predict and help you manage what's going on at the given moment.
Okay. I'm going to make a confession right now that I've never told anybody this, but I remember I was in elementary school, okay? And I grew up, we didn't have a TV when I was growing up. I read a ton of books in elementary school, it was like fourth or fifth grade, and we were watching a suspenseful movie around Halloween. And I became like physically uncomfortable and made the excuse that told the teacher, like, I didn't feel well, I needed to go see the nurse because I was just freaked out by the movie, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, what are the skills then that you are teaching people to say, okay, when you get into these circumstances, it's more than just psychological, it can actually affect you physically. What are the tools to handle this more than just kind of, you know, buck up and get over it?
Yeah. And the tools are important, and there's a lot of different ones you can try, and you have to find the ones that work for you. Some of the ones that I teach that I find help with a lot of clients is the first thing I always teach people to say is, what else could be true? So when you go into a situation, you don't know everything. Your brain remembers things through stories. And so your brain will fill in the blanks. But because we're fear-based animals, it fills in from a fear standpoint. So you may go into a sales pitch and you may only know one person in the room, but you don't know who the other three are. So your brain may be saying, oh, these people are going to be the tough ones. This, you know, I looked them up on LinkedIn and this is the person who's in charge. So I bet she's going to be really tough. Like your brain starts telling you that. Well, I always say, well, what else could be true? What else could be true is that same person in the room is the one who cannot wait to meet you, cannot wait to help hear how you can help solve their problems. What else could be true is there's extra people coming to this meeting because they're so excited to hear what you have to say. All of that could also be true. You don't know. So if you don't know the truth and you're going to make it up, at least make up something that helps you and is awesome, right? You can be like the best person in your mind if you don't know the truth. And so that is one of the first things I teach people is to always say, what else could be true?
Okay. You're helping me tremendously because the question that is in my mind is not what else could be true. It's what else can go wrong. Changing that inner dialogue from looking for the negative, having that fear base, is changing to, you know, the opening yourself to the possibility that there are positives that are out there and that it's not always negative. Is this something that you have kind of, and maybe we talked about this already, but when did you kind of develop this concept of dealing with the neuroscience of fear? Is it something that you came across through retail, through, you know, self-improvement? How did you come across this?
One of the things that I've always committed to is that I'm always in an education program. At least once a year, I take a personal development education program. And several years ago, I was out looking for the one of the year, and I came across Judith Glasher's work. And she has a program called Conversation Intelligence. And so I was like, well, I don't know much about this. And it talked about the neuroscience of the brain. And I was like, what's all that? So I took that course. It was a year long. And I mean, I was like, what? Like, if I'd only known this stuff before. So I learned so much from her. And she really inspired me then to go out and start to learn more. So constantly reading books. And I'm in completely different neuroscience coaching class right now. But I am, which is funny because speaking back to, you know, grade school and school, I hated science, but I'm fascinated as an adult to learn about the human brain and how it really does impact our quality of life. And when we start to understand it, and we don't not only lead our own life through understanding our mind, but we lead teams that way, then big things start to happen in a good way. And oftentimes when I'm working with an individual, they're using what they have been told are best practice leadership skills, but they were, you know, a lot of these practices we've been taught were created in the 60s, maybe the 70s. Well, the world was a little different back then. And things were just different and how we looked at things different. And we also knew very little, if not anything, about the chemicals and how our brain actually functioned. What we know about the brain today, which is very little, we've only been able to discover about the last 25 years. Because, you know, you can look at a heart and kind of tinker with it and put it back in. And you can do that with a kidney. Can't really do that with a brain. It's really hard. The brain's kind of got to stay in its place.
Right.
And so now that we have all this new information, then we start to think about how we use language or how we lead in the workplace. And we take in today's world, we take in the knowledge of the brain, and then we create leadership best practices. And that's a whole new way to lead and a whole new way to get business results.
Yeah, what we know about the brain is so limited, and yet the more we look at it, the more it, you know. Here's what I think about, and that is, you know, the first computer that was invented took up an entire city block, and you know, the cell phone that you have in your hand is far more powerful than that entire thing ever was and ever hoped to be. Okay. And yet the cell phone that you have in your hand is not nearly as complex as what your brain is. And when you begin to understand the nuances of the brain and the way that it all works, it's incredible. And so what do you say to people who are like, okay, Jen, this works for you, but you don't understand my life and you don't understand the way that my brain works. It works for you, but it's probably not going to work for me. So what's your response?
So my response to this is that everyone does have a unique mind map. So our brain only knows what it's seen, touched, felt, smelled, experienced. That is true. Everyone's mind has a different map. And even if you took two people who had very similar experiences, their mind map's going to be different. On one Tuesday, they were in different places and created something different in their mind map. So I would say that's true. Everyone's mind map is different. But how it works from a neurological standpoint, that is similar across everyone. Now, our sensitivity to chemicals, the way our chemicals respond based on our mind map, again, unique. But everyone has chemicals in their brain. Everyone's brain is working from a space of, you know, the left hemisphere, the right hemisphere, your prefrontal cortex, your primitive brain. Everyone has those. And so everyone's machine is the same, but how you operate that machine is unique. And that's what we work on, the unique operating system of that brain.
Okay. So people that have been listening to the show for a while know that I am the very proud father of triplets. I've got a boy and two girls. And I think that this goes to the point that you were just making. They were born at the same time, to the same parents, raised in the same house. They slept in the same room for like the first 6 years of their life. And their circumstances could not be more similar. And yet they are as different as night, day, and pineapples. Okay. They're just three unique individuals. And yet when you look at, I mean, the basics, right? They've each got a right and a left arm, and they've got two legs. They've got two, you know, and so from one perspective, they are entirely unique individuals, and they have their own way of thinking, and yet in a similar way they are very much the same in the way that they are built and composed. What's your reaction to that analogy?
So yeah, they are the same, and they do, you know, both have, you know, a left and a right arm, right? So my guess is, since they both have a left and a right arm, then they may use the writing utensil with one of those arms, right. But their handwriting is still different because of the person who may have taught them how to hold that pen, their own personal, you know, likes of, you know, they like big letters, or are they, you know, someone who likes the nice tight, you know, block letters. And so, and that's how our life is. And though all three of them were raised in the same home, they may, if you think about your family traditions, you know, they may all have very similar feelings towards what you do on your, you know, your holidays. But yet one of the three may have had a bad day during one of those holidays. And so their view may be different, where the other two are like, we love 4th of July with our family. And the other one might be going, I burned my finger on a firework. 4th of July is no longer my thing. Again, they all had the same experience, but yet it was different.
Cool. I want to go back to something in it. And you had given us one tip as far as changing the question that you ask yourself. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some other practical tips on how to handle that fear situation?
Well, when you were talking after that first one, it made me think of my second favorite one to teach, and that is what could go right. So oftentimes we do, like, we have a project or we have something and we go, what could go wrong? And so we then say, what do I have to do to make sure that doesn't go wrong? But what I like to say is, what could go right? And what's the best case scenario? Then the work is the same. You do the same work to figure out how to make it go right. And so when you say what could go wrong, instantly your brain's like, oh, we could get hurt. We could be like, this could go bad. And so those fear chemicals go up, the access to creativity goes down, you got to do the work to figure out it, make sure it doesn't go wrong, but you don't have as much creativity to do that. Or you could say, what could go right? Well, what could go right is we're going to do this and we're going to seal this deal and our business is going to be fantastic and all this could go right. All right. Now we have that chemical of success in our brain. So our creativity opens up. What do we have to do to make sure it goes right? The work is exactly the same, but how you access your thoughts around it changes completely by just changing your view from what could go wrong to what could go right.
So it's as simple as just changing the questions that you're asking yourself. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
It can be, absolutely. And you think about it as a leader, say you have 10 people on your team and you're walking around going, oh my gosh, if this goes wrong, we're all going to be in trouble. I'm not going to make payroll. Like, and you're walking around with all that. Well, guess what? All 10 people in the room are also now walking around with that fear too. Uh-oh, if we don't get this right, I might not have a job. I'm not going to be able to feed my family. So they start, you know, spiraling into fear. But if you're like, guys, we're going to land this and here's how it's going to happen and this is what it's going to look like. What do we have to do to make this come true? Then everyone else on the team all of a sudden is starting to raise up to that also. And so it is sometimes as simple as changing our language and understanding that that language impacts our emotions, feelings, therefore it impacts our actions.
Okay. And maybe this is a super complicated question to ask as the very last thing, but when you're working on that positive mindset, you're working to look at, you know, what else could be true and how can this go right? What do you do then when it doesn't necessarily go right? We've had the positive talk and we said this is going to go well and you don't land the contract. How do you handle that? The fallout from that.
I love that you asked that because sometimes it doesn't go the way you want it. And again, you could take that and imprint on your brain that you're now a failure, that you'll never close a deal again. You can imprint all of that and your brain will believe what you tell it. And if that's what you tell it, then guess what? That's going to be your future. Or you could say, we didn't get this contract. Here's what we learned. Now we have space to open up for a different client that might be the right client. And I do that all the time. I wish I got every contract I pitch for. I don't. But when we don't get a client, we say, what did we learn? How can we be better? And I always say, well, it opens it up for the best client that comes next. And I truly believe that because that's what I tell myself over and over again. And then the next client shows up and we land it. And I wouldn't have been able to work with that great client if that other one hadn't said no to us. And so you just have to decide, how do you want that memory to imprint on your brain? Because that creates the prediction for the next time.
Yeah. I heard someone say recently, just very similar to what you say, to reframe that experience to say, it's not, I didn't get this contract and that doesn't mean I'm a failure. It means I'm a learner. And how do I learn from what's going on? Listen, Jen, you've been phenomenal. You've shared a lot of stuff, given us a lot to think about. If people want to connect with you, learn more about what you do, how's the best way to do that?
You can find us on our website at 304coaching.com. You can connect with me directly on LinkedIn at Jen Thornton, ACC, and we can continue the conversation.
Absolutely. And I will be delighted to put those links down in the show notes and make sure that people can get connected with you. And it's phenomenal work that you're doing. Thank you so much for that. We have come to the time for three questions to establish your humanity. Are you ready for this, my friend?
I think so. Let's do this.
What would be the title of your memoir? If you were writing your autobiography, what would you call it?
She did it her way. I've been in trouble a lot in my life for doing it my way, but I don't care.
That is so funny. And, you know, listen, Frank Sinatra's not the only one that has dibs on that, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. If you're making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, there's a number of different parameters that go in here. Which goes on first, peanut butter or the jelly?
Oh, always peanut butter and extra crunchy.
Okay. Now, do you put peanut butter on both pieces of bread or just on one?
Just on one. I wish I could do two, but I always think I should save those calories.
Okay. All right. From a practical perspective, I learned that if you put peanut butter on both pieces of bread, that when you the top piece of bread doesn't get soggy from the jelly. That's a must do when you, like when you send peanut butter and jelly in your lunch, having the double peanut butter barrier keeps your bread from getting, all right. Are you eating it crust on or crust off?
Crust on.
Okay. And are you, when you're cutting it, are you cutting it on the diagonal or are you cutting it, on the, like the square?
On the diagonal.
Excellent. Last question for you, is do you trust your own memory?
No.
So do you have any tips on how you help yourself to make sure that you can remember things just because your memory may not be perfect all the time?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You could do a whole podcast on memory. So memories are created through emotions and how you felt about the situation, not always what actually happened. And so I trust my feelings towards that memory, but I don't always trust the details. So I think journaling early and often is one of the best ways to create trust your memory, or remind yourself those memories are maybe are just stories and not necessarily facts.
Fantastic. Jen, thank you so much for being here. Folks, I'd encourage you to go check out her website, connect with her on LinkedIn, and see what you can learn. I appreciate all of you for being with us today. You have definitely learned from a smart person, and I will remind you that when you stop learning, you stop living. Have a great day, everybody.